like Robert Wong and Mark Lifman, that all had a connection with the president. Robert Wong, for example, and Poli has written about him as well. He's that a Chinese immigrant came to commit. He was sentenced to, I think, 12 years imprisonment, inexplicably only served 4 years. Came out, formed a company by the name of Mpisi Trading, appointed Kulabusi Zuma as the chairperson of his company, accompanied Zuma on business trips to China, and in 2014 he imported T-shirts for the ANC during the election. Wong got a 1 billion rand tax bill from SARS at the beginning of 2014, which has now grown to 3 billion rand. That's already like 10% of Moyani's shortfall in his first tax year. But anyway, Wong has never paid his tax bill. Nothing has ever happened. Poli has written about that as well. Mark Lifman, and you've all heard the name Mark Lifman a lot recently, a Cape Land gangster who's involved in the bouncer wars in the Western Cape, whose right-hand man is a guy called Donkey Boyson, who's a very notorious gangster. Mark Lifman got a tax bill of 388 million rand. He's never paid his tax bill either. And I can go on and on and on about tax bills that were never paid after Tom Moyani became the commissioner of SARS in October 2014. When Moyani became the president, he dissolved the 5 investigative units of SARS. SARS doesn't have the ability to investigate organized criminals and extract taxes from the informal economy or the illicit economy. It must be the only revenue service in the world that doesn't have an investigative capacity. Under Moyani, as I said, 30 billion rand shortfall in the first tax year, a 50 billion rand shortfall in the previous tax year. So SARS has virtually been destroyed. Within a year of Moyani taking over, more than 50 senior managers left SARS. Same has happened in the Hawks, where good people, very dedicated civil servants like Anwar Dramat, Shadrach Sabia, Johan Boysen, have been worked out of the Hawks. They were extracted from the organization by a range of dirty tricks, and I won't even go into that detail. State security, where Zuma in August 2016 appointed Arthur Fraser, who's a crony. Arthur Fraser was the man who handed the spy tapes to Zuma. And despite the fact that Fraser is implicated in a billion rand of wastage, Zuma still appointed him as our spy boss, which is a crucial position in the civil service. You know, so while we've seen political changes happening under Ramaphosa, and remember, I mean, we have to give the man some time, we haven't seen any changes in the organizations yet. You know, we're waiting for Abrams to go, we're waiting for Moyani to go. But the law enforcement agencies have been hollowed out. There's very, very, very little left.
So, Jock, I want to talk for a moment about the future of our country. I have this interesting story. The other day, and I haven't told you about it yet, but the other day I came to Cape Town and I asked one of the NEC members. The ANC has an NEC body, a National Executive Committee. And from these people, some of them got appointed as ministers just now in Ramaphosa's new reshuffle. So one of these people that got appointed as a minister just now told me, I asked for a briefing about Ramaphosa and the ANC and where we're going and so on. And the person tells me that they read the book, The President's Keepers, and that it was the first time that they realized, and these are people that work with our country every day. They sit in parliament, they sit in committees, they're important people. They're important for our country, and they make decisions that affect us all. And the guy tells me, I didn't realize the breadth and the width of the lie and the corruption and the rot in South Africa until I read President's Keepers. And when Gupta Leaks came out, then we realized, and then we realized something must be done. Isn't that also an extreme indictment if someone in high decision-making structures in the ANC comes to tell you that, you know, we didn't know.
Mm. It reminds one very much of when the previous dispensation, when National Party ministers and somebody like F.W. de Klerk went to the Truth Commission, and they said, but we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know about the existence of Vlakplaas and Eugene de Kock and Dirk Coetzee and the CCB and these people and organizations. Nonsense. You know, if you want to know, you are going to know. You know, if these cabinet ministers or NEC members or whatever, if they have read Daily Maverick and the Mail and Guardian and these publications on a regular basis, they would have known what was going on. Remember that President's Keepers only came out at the end of October last year. I mean, Gupta emails, I mean, the work that Amabungani, for example, the investigative arm of the Mail and Guardian have done. You know, it is a very lame excuse to say, listen, we didn't know what was going on. Zuma's corruption comes along for, I mean, it's been going on forever. You know, it's not as though it started in 2017 or 16 or 2015. It's been going on forever. I mean, the way that people like Anwar Dramat, for example, the dirty tricks that they played against him. I mean, you know, it's old. You know, they must know about it.
So journalists are very critical about the ANC and about the governing party. But let's be critical about journalists themselves at the moment. As proud as we are about what we did and how we sort of turned the future, would you agree? Your book and the Gupta League sort of turned the future.
I think in the past 2 years, the media has been magnificent. Yeah. You know, I've always said there's only three factors standing between us and a gangster state. And the one is the courts, which has been doing magnificently. The other is civil society and the media. You know, if it wasn't for the media, I mean, we wouldn't have known about Nkandla or the Guptas or anything like that. So they have been doing very well.
But now our conundrum is this. If it wasn't for the media, we wouldn't have Johan Boysen out. Mm. We wouldn't have Dramat out. We wouldn't have SARS's problems with Ivan Pillay and Johan van Lochrenberg out. There might have been problems in the SSA that wouldn't have manifested. Can you discuss that for us?
You know, unfortunately, there's also some rotten apples in the media. Mm. And the investigative unit at the Sunday Times was used by forces to help to get rid of people like Anwar Dramat, Shadrach Sabir, Johan Boysen, and the top structure of SARS, basically by planting stories on them. You know, in the case of Johan Boysen, for example, who's a fantastic policeman, the last 5 years of his police career, he basically fought suspension after suspension after suspension because of a story that was planted in the Sunday Times about the fact that he was directly involved in the so-called Cato Manor death squad. Now, I think it was quite legitimate for the Sunday Times to ask questions about the high death rate of the Cato Manor policemen, but they desperately tried to link Johan Boysen directly into the activities of the unit. And why did they do that? Because Johan Boysen was investigating Toshan Pandey, which is a crony of Jacob Zuma. Anwar Dramat was removed as the head of the Hawks, and he's a terribly credible policeman. Anwar Dramat was removed as the head of the Hawks because he wanted to charge Richard Medluli, who was the head of crime intelligence and also Zuma crony. So they had to get rid of Anwar Dramat. As I've just told you, they had to get rid of the top structure of SARS. And they used the Sunday Times, who came with their so-called SARS rogue unit narrative. They published something like 120 articles over a period of 2 years about the fact that the investigative units at SARS were rogue. They claimed that they backed Zuma, they were running a brothel. It was all nonsense. this didn't exist. I mean, the Sunday Times have apologized for the articles they published. Most of the journalists of that rogue unit left. Incidentally, two of them want to sue me now for defamation because I say ugly things about them in the book. And I've written back to them and I said to them, I would love you to sue me. Come, let's go to court. Anyway, so the media has been used and the media has been abused in order to facilitate state capture, unfortunately.
So, Jacques, we are as good journalists, are as good as our sources, and sometimes as our whistleblowers. And these people, sometimes we ferret them out, and other times they tend to find us.
Mm.
Can you tell us a bit about how you found some of these people and how you kept them safe? Because obviously everyone is looking for your sources at the moment. And tell us about this Russian that you had met and how that happened.
You know, when I started writing the book, one of the first people I went to see was, in fact, Poli, to go and ask about certain characters. Now, what helped a lot is the fact that I wasn't a journalist anymore when I wrote this book. With other words, there was no kind of like any kind of focus on me. I could do it very, very quietly. And I didn't plan to write this book. I didn't plan to ever write again. You know, I resigned from journalism towards the end of 2014. And then for 2 years, I cooked very happily in my kitchen. But the whole time, and I have to say this in Afrikaans, ek het net so die donor ingeword vir wat besig was om in die land te gebeur. I was getting so angry at what was happening in the country. You know, I would get up every morning and I would read the news and read Daily Maverick and all of them. And I would realize that things are going very, very badly. And of course, the fact that Max de Pree lives in the same town as I didn't help either, because he was stoking the fire from one side as well. And at some point, Max said to me, listen, you've done your national service twice. The once, first time when I was a young man and I had to go to the army for 2 years, and the second time was at Vrije Weerplaat when we exposed death squads. He said to me, now you have to do your national service for a third time. And I was resisting this, and then I got this phone call from a person who said to me, there's someone in Russia who can tell you more about the fraud and corruption in state security. Within a week, I was on an aeroplane to Moscow. Now, I say to people, you know, I think journalists are like rehabilitated heroin addicts. You never quite get over it. And when I got that information about this person in Russia, it was as though somebody handed me a syringe full of heroin. I couldn't help injecting myself, and off I went. And I became an addict again. As I said, it helped a lot that I wasn't a journalist when I wrote this book. And the people I approached to talk to as well, and my ex-colleagues, journalists who are in the field at the moment, people like Poli, was terribly important in giving me directions. And some of them gave me some names of people I could contact. And when I contacted these people, and these were officials inside the law enforcement agencies, I think it helped a lot that I wasn't a journalist anymore. That I could say to them, don't worry, you're not going to be in the Sunday Times on Sunday. You know, I'm writing a book, and they knew exactly what I was doing. And it was, to a certain extent, it was safe to communicate with them because I wasn't a journalist any longer. We had to take a lot of measures about what we're going to do once the book is published, because I knew that the law enforcement agencies will come for me. So literally the day before the book was published, I cut all communication with all my sources, and I haven't spoken to them since. I'm not even going to attempt to see them for a long time to safeguard them. You know, after I published the book, and in the book I wrote about the fraud and corruption of Arthur Fraser, and then someone I knew, in fact I'm going to mention her name, Glynis Breitenbach, who's the DA, and also one of the people who had to leave the NPA because she wanted to prosecute Madluli. Anyway, Glynis Breitenbach, and she won't mind me telling this story, Glynis Breitenbach got a phone call from an official in the State Security Agency who wanted to give her the reports of the Inspector General of Intelligence about Fraser and the failed project he controlled. And these reports were terribly important. I couldn't get them while I wrote the book. I got other reports, but not the reports of the IG. Anyway, so Glynis phoned me and she said, I'm coming to Pretoria. I was in Johannesburg then. She said, I'm flying up from Cape Town. We're going to go and get these reports tonight. So I had to meet Glynis literally next to the highway between, and this was like 11 o'clock at night, between Johannesburg and Pretoria. And the next moment, this massive BMW X5 arrived with Glynis and two bodyguards. And it turned out to be the BMW of the billionaire Izzy Kirsch, who's a very good friend of Breitenbach. So when he heard where she was going, he said, no, 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 you take my armored-plated X5 with the bodyguards. So off we went to Pretoria in this like an armored vehicle. Anyway, we had to meet this person in a schoolyard in Pretoria. So now it was like 12 o'clock at night, and this guy had to sneak out of the house, got onto his bicycle, and he went to the school. And he said he had to do it very quietly because he didn't want his wife to wake up, because he didn't want her to know what he was doing. Anyway, he was waiting for us at the schoolyard at 12 o'clock at night. And here we came with this BMW, this huge black thing with bodyguards. And as we approached him, he put his hands in the air. He thought it was state security was onto him. Anyway, so we got the IG reports, and they were published in Daily Maverick. So I'm very, you know, there's lots of people who contacted me after writing the book. People who want to give me more information. I haven't contacted them because I'm going to jeopardize them, because I know that state security and the hawks are listening to my phone and they're probably intercepting my emails and whatever. So at the moment, it's very difficult for me to do journalism because of the fact that I'm scrutinized, and it's very difficult for people to talk to me at the moment.
So now that you dished on Glynis, dish a bit more. So I've heard that you had to edit out a lot of the things that you knew was correct, and your editor had a lot of faith in, but when it comes to the court, you couldn't necessarily prove it. Is there some of those things that you edited out that you can share with us?
Like what?
Well, you know, Mr. Zuma is gone now, so maybe start with Mr. Zuma.
Well, you know, when you write a book like this, when I started writing the book and I had a discussion with the publishers, they said to me, do you think you can write 90,000 words? So I said to them, I'll try, because I had only 9 months to write this book. I said to them, and do the research. And I said to them, I'll try. And when I get to 100,000 words, they say to me, okay, you can stop now. And when I get to 110,000 words, they say to you, you must absolutely stop now. There's much more I could have written. And there's much more, there is stuff we took out in the end because, you know, listen, we consulted with senior counsel, with the senior advocate before we published the book. Because we knew there were going to be legal challenges. And I'm quite satisfied that if I have to go to court, I can prove each and every allegation in the book. But there were stuff we took out.
So no dishing. Okay, so last question before we go to the crowd for questions. I am interested in the personal toll President Skeep has had on your life. When I saw this week's police raid on the restaurant, why did they choose the restaurant?
I don't know. Ask.
Why not your house?
Ask the bright colonel why they... I don't know.
So when they conducted this raid, it's a terribly invasive situation. Mm. And I thought of you and I thought, yes, it's terrible. Because we spoke on the phone that very morning. Mm. But my thoughts weren't with you. My thoughts were with Sam. And I know that the people around us sometimes suffer because of us. Mm. I know that you had bodyguards at one stage.
I had a bodyguard only for a week.
Did you fire him?
Yes, kind of. You know, I had a bodyguard. His name was Jabu. He's a block of a man, a block. And he came with a gun as well. He had a gun. Anyway, so Jabu would fetch me at the hotel every morning. And when I had my first book launch at Exclusive Books in Hyde Park in Johannesburg, that's when the lights went off. And Exclusives is still convinced that it was sabotage.
It's constructed
anyway, again. Yeah. So that night when the lights went off, Jabu grabbed me off the stage and we went through little alleys and into the car and gone. Anyway, so the next night I had my book launch at Exclusives in Pretoria. So when he came to fetch me, then he also had a torch. And he said he's not taking any chances. So I had a bodyguard for a week, and then I didn't want a bodyguard anymore. You know, lots of people ask me, aren't you scared? And no, I'm not scared. And I'm not scared because of two things. The first is that millions of South Africans are protecting me. That's the first one. People like you. And the second thing is, I have the Constitution. So come on. You know, this is not apartheid South Africa. This is not Zimbabwe or North Korea or Turkey or anything like that. This is South Africa, and we live in a constitutional democracy. So I'm not scared. You know, I had a few threatening phone calls. Now, I've always believed that if somebody calls you, he's not serious to kill you because he's not going to warn you beforehand. So I'm not scared. That, you know, the biggest, and I mean, you're a journalist. You know that once you've started something, you have to see it through. There's no way that you can stop halfway. So I have to go through it. The most terrible thing of this whole experience for me has been the fact that I have to talk to people, and I have to tell. I'm very honest about it. I'm not an extrovert, certainly not. I love to sit in my corner and write and that kind of thing. So the fact that I suddenly became a celebrity has been a terrible thing for me. You know, I can't go anywhere. I mean, a while ago, I got away for 2 weeks. I had to go overseas. Otherwise, people recognize me. I can't move around in my own country anymore. I go to Checkers and people stop me and they want selfies, you know. No, it is terrible. I mean, the worst is the airport, because you can't escape from an airport. I mean, when you're in an airport, you're in an airport. And yeah, that's been terrible for me. You know, I also don't know what I am at the moment. I don't know whether I'm a chef, whether I'm a writer, whether I'm a journalist. I suffer from an identity crisis at the moment, but I'm sure I'll get over it. So that's been terrible. And I mean, there's a huge amount of speaking lying ahead, you know, book festivals and whatever. The toll for my wife Sam has been terrible. Also because it's removed me from the Retton Roof and removed me from the guest house and the restaurant. So I've given her a lot to cope with. And I mean, the stress is very high. But I mean, you know, like the raid this week, all they've accomplished is quite frankly. You know, so there's no way we will back down or anything. I mean, I will see this through.
So I think there are people here that would really want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Do we have a mic for questions? Fantastic. I think we have like 10 to 15 minutes. So please stand up or put your hand up. Tell us who you are and then ask Jock a question.
No questions.
No questions. They're in the balcony. While she's taking the mic up there, I want to ask you, are you going to write a second book, a follow-up with all the...
Don't ask me that. I don't know. You know, things are happening at such a pace in the country at the moment. I mean, I've got lots more about fraud and corruption that were committed under Zuma, but I'm not sure how relevant that's going to be by the end of the year. Mm. You know, so I would like to write another book, but I'm waiting for the right moment to happen.
Hello, can you hear me? My name is Klaus Parkendorf. The question is, can we trust Cyril Ramaphosa?
What about Cyril Ramaphosa?
Can we trust him?
Can we trust him? We can trust him as far as you can trust any politician, quite frankly. And that's not very far. I have very, very little faith in politicians. And we mustn't forget that Ramaphosa sat next to Zuma since May 2014, when he became the deputy president, has praised Zuma for his leadership in parliament and things like that. I think Ramaphosa is the best we can do at the moment. I think he's clever, and I think we can trust him as far as you can trust a politician. I think what he has done up to now has been significant. I think many of his moves have been excellent. The fact that he removed 7 or 8 captured ministers from the cabinet has been brilliant. I think the appointment of Pravin Gordhan and Nene and Bekele have all been very good. We now have to see how he intends to restructure the law enforcement agencies and, of course, deal with the land issue, which is another hot potato. You know, I've always said that there's only one way that Ramaphosa can bring about justice, and that is he has to bring back the old guard. He has to bring back the people that they removed from the civil service. He has to bring back the top structure of SARS. He has to bring back Dramat and Sabia and Boysen and people like that. So we will have to see. I mean, you know, I think it's fair to say that I'm cautiously optimistic. And, my God, what a relief to get rid of Zuma, you know, and I truly believe he is going to be charged, and it's going to be very good for the psyche of the country, and it's going to be very good for justice if he is charged. But I'm hopeful about Ramaphosa. I'm not so hopeful about the people surrounding him, but let's see how he copes with it.
And maybe we should also trust in the people. We should trust in the whistleblowers who started this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's so many people here that have really sort of like done so brilliantly. People, civil servants that were prepared to come forward and speak out. People who have put their careers on the line. People who have put their jobs on the line to speak out about this corruption and state capture. You know, unfortunately, in a democracy, people sometimes make terrible mistakes. I mean, the Americans have just done it, haven't they? But anyway. And I mean, we made a terrible mistake by appointing Zuma as the president. And if we look back, we all now ask the question, how could we have appointed a man who was facing 783 charges of fraud and corruption and at the very least had slept with a HIV-positive daughter of a friend, that kind of thing. So yes, I mean, we've made a terrible mistake, and hopefully we're not going to repeat it. But then I look at somebody like Didi Mabuza as the deputy president, and one wonders whether there's another calamity coming, but that's another discussion.
Next question.
Jock, Ulrich Ruh speaking. In 2006, you brought a book out called Dances with Devils.
Yeah.
Which sparked quite a bit of criticism, and especially from the apartheid regime, and a big fallout. Can you compare that fallout to the fallout from the president's keepers?
You know, it's ironic that when I wrote this book, I felt as though I was back in the dark days of apartheid when we wrote about death squads. Because lots of the people I spoke to had the same fear that the people back then had, that their phones are listened to, that they followed around. Remember we've had so many dirty tricks in the past 2 years, mysterious break-ins. You know, we had Bernie Klemesas, the head of the Hawks, who had a unit that was collecting the sensitive dockets in order that they don't get prosecuted. So to a certain extent, I feel as though I'm living back during the years of apartheid. But then I didn't have a constitution, and I was not living in a constitutional democracy, which I am now, which is one of the things protecting me. So we have to remember we have a magnificent constitution, and that is protecting all of us. But it is strange, the comparison, and I couldn't help making it, that in certain ways I felt as though I was back in the dark old days. I mean, when those cops walked through the door, nobody raided me during the apartheid years. I mean, we dealt with terribly sensitive information then. We reported on Eugene de Kock and death squads and whatever. Nobody raided me then. I mean, why is the Hawks' elite unit, the crimes against the state, investigating me? They're supposed to investigate acts of terrorism and ISIS and things like that. Now they're investigating me. I mean, so, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I do feel as though I'm back in the dark old days.
We have a question here.
Can I just ask you, would you like to speculate who gave this instruction to raid you?
Sorry, say again?
Would you like to speculate who do you think gave the instruction now to raid you?
Well, you know, as I've said before, we've had political changes. We haven't had changes in the police yet. Now, I've just mentioned the name of Bernie Klemesa, who was a terrible man. And he, again, appointed 9 provincial commissioners, provincial heads of the Hawks. Many of them have never been policemen before. He appointed, for example, a person as the head of the Hawks in the Western Cape, who used to work for the asset forfeiture unit in Kimberley and got 47% in her last assessment at the AFU. She's now the head of the Hawks in the Western Cape. She knows nothing about police work. Nklemesa appointed a man called Prince Mokotedi as the head of the Hawks in Gauteng. Prince Mokotedi comes from the NPA, where he was the head of integrity. And he left the NPA just before he would have faced disciplinary charges. Mokotedi is the head of the Hawks in Gauteng, and I wouldn't be surprised if that is where the instruction come from. And if Cyril Ramaphosa hopes to make any progress, he'll have to get rid of these people. And we all know it's terribly difficult in South Africa to get rid of a civil servant. It's going to cost a huge amount of money, because they all have 5-year contracts, and they're probably now into year 2 or 3 of their contracts. So the rot still exists in the police, and I suspect that's where the instruction come from. The cops who were there, really, I mean, the colonel told me a few times, I'm only doing my job. You know, but somewhere in the top echelons of the Hawks is a person who thought it's okay to raid a journalist.
We have another question there at the back.
Could you say something about Zuma and populism?
Zuma and?
Populism.
Populism.
Oh, populism. You know, it's such a loaded term, and it's not really my field of expertise. Pauli can probably say more about it. I think populism is so dangerous for us. Because the whole land issue is based on populism. It's based on the populist idea that you can take farms or you can take land and you can simply redistribute them. So I'm very wary about populism. And Zuma very much was a populist. And I mean, the irony is, under Zuma, less land was redistributed than under the combined regimes of Thabo Mbeki and Nelson Mandela. So in Zuma's case, who was a complete populist, it was very destructive for the ANC. The fact that they adapted at their conference a resolution to expropriate land without compensation wasn't thought through at all. And I don't know whether they realize what the consequences of that is. But I'm not really an expert in that field.
Another question? Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Erica from Stellenbosch. I'm very happy to hear that you are confident that Mr. Zuma will be charged. I'm more worried about Ace Magashule, who is actually presently, I think, the most powerful person in the ANC. My personal opinion. What do you think are the chances that Ace Magashule will be charged and removed from government? Because he seems to be the one calling the shots.
I'm going to throw that question to Poli. No, I mean, she works on this. What's the chances of Magashule being charged? Because I think Zwani is definitely in line to be charged.
Most Magashule? Definitely. So Magashule, his involvement was also in the Istina farm situation with the Guptas and the money that was laundered through Dubai right back to pay for the wedding and the Optimum mine. And Ace Magashule always covered for Zwani. And I think the most important thing that gave us hope for the Hawks was the psychological barrier that they thrashed through the moment that they'd gone and raided Ace Magashule's office. It is not a small thing. There are journalists here who can tell you that 5 years ago, you wouldn't have thought ever that the ANC offices somewhere would have been raided. It was quite a thing. So I think there's definitely a chance, but it will also come down on us. And if I say us, I mean the people of South Africa. Because the people of South Africa got us to this point. Don't think that it's only the politicians that now make decisions and that we're now sort of on the right track. It's the people of South Africa that said, I'm putting my foot down, not in my name, and you're going to do the right thing now. NGOs started to initiate court cases. People like everyday man started to give journalists information. You strengthened the journalists' hands. And the same will be with ACE. If we start to again retract into ourselves, and if we decide to not be involved as citizens, ACE won't be charged, I promise you that. If we stand up and if we say, not in my name, ACE will be charged.
I think it's very important what she's saying is, and I always say to people, don't think because Ramaphosa is now in power, we can all now sit back and relax for a while. We can't. It was civil society that got rid of people like Ntlemeza and Jiba and is probably going to get rid of Sean Abrams and people like that. And it was civil society that brought Zuma to his knees. It wasn't the ANC that brought Zuma to his, it was civil society. It was the outcry by civil society. And we have to be very careful that we don't sit back and relax. We have to be vigilant. People have to give information to the media. You have to write letters to newspapers. You have to participate in marches and what. You know, people must be vigilant and active, and you know, we must all be activists for freedom and for democracy and for justice. And I think, yeah, then somebody like Magashule might be charged.
On that note, Almarie just cut us off. So I just want to read a very last bit from your book and then say thank you to everyone here, because it's people like you that give strength to Jacques and what he does. So one of the most powerful sentences or paragraphs in your book came right at the end of your acknowledgements. And you said here, I am deeply indebted to them, and you're talking about your sources and your and the people around you. I'm deeply indebted to them and honor their courage for putting their jobs on the line by divulging the dirty secrets of Jacob Zuma's keepers to me. And then this powerful line, I hope I have done justice to their pursuit for a better South Africa. If we have people like that in the country, we'll be fine.